it is dying, right? The old world is dying, and that means that the new one is like, right? Like we can shape it. And like part of the importance of Palestinian liberation is not just that it's like a moral imperative in its own right. Like these are subjugated people who, like every people on earth, deserves to be free. But it is also like one of the first large battles in shaping this new world order. And of course, like the PFLP very much understood this. Like each blow against the imperialist in one area is a blow against imperialism in toto. And I think that's still very much alive, and like really like the unconditional solidarity with the Palestinians and with Palestinian resistance is not just, again, a moral imperative in its own right, but there's also like you need to be thinking prudentially and for yourself as well, that every battle against this emerging like fascist international order is one in which you need to support the people fighting against that fascism. And yeah, it really is like the moral imperative of our time.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Red Medicine, a podcast about the politics of health, medicine, and the body. My name is Sam Kelly, and in this episode, I'm joined by Jake Rom to talk about anti-Semitism and Zionism, and why they have much more in common than separates them. Before we get to that, though, and as with every episode, I'd just like to say a huge thank you to everyone who supports the podcast. If you're listening and you enjoy Red Medicine and you'd also like to support the podcast, you could do several things. You could use the link in the show notes to sign up for a monthly donation. You could give the show 5 stars on Apple or Spotify. Or importantly, you could share this episode with a friend that you think might enjoy it. Finally, I'll also just say quickly that I'm posting a lot more on Substack now because Twitter is increasingly broken for sharing links and I think probably sharing anything vaguely left-wing. So if you want to keep up with everything, including episodes, but also some of my writing, I'm actually writing a new series at the minute on Phil Neal's Hell World over on Substack. So if you would like to keep up to date, please go and subscribe over there. The URL is www.redmedicine.substack.com. So today's episode, joined by Jake Rom. Jake is a writer and human rights lawyer based in New York. He is an associate editor of Protean magazine and the US representative for the Hind Rajab Foundation. If you don't know about the Hind Rajab Foundation, I really encourage you to go and look at the work they do. It's very good. Jake's writing has appeared in several places, including The Nation, Brooklyn Rail, The Baffler, Pyrapraxis, and many other places as well. And in this conversation, we're going to be talking about Zionism and anti-Semitism. Specifically, we're going to be drawing on two of Jake's recent essays, both of which published in Pyrapraxis, which argue that anti-Semitism and Zionism are much more consistent with each other than we're often told. In this conversation, we discuss the work of mid-century thinkers such as Jean-Paul Sartre, Theodore Adorno, and Max Horkheimer, as well as recent scholarship from people like Nadia Abu El Haj, who herself has been on Red Medicine, and highly recommend you go back and listen to that episode, as well as the writing of Palestinian political prisoners. Jake draws on all of these thinkers to better understand the many consistencies between anti-Semitic and Zionist ideology. And of course, as with every episode, I would like to take the opportunity to extend and reiterate my solidarity with the Palestinian people and join with the millions of people around the world calling for an end to the genocide and a free Palestine from the river to the sea. With all that being said, we'll now move on to the conversation with Jake. For most listeners, they'll be very familiar with a link between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, but we'll be familiar with it in as much as we're constantly told that anti-Semitism is an outgrowth of anti-Zionism, or anti-Zionism, quote-unquote, veers into anti-Semitism. Increasingly, since Operation Al-Aqsa Flood and the intensification of Zionist violence, reaching the definition of genocide in the last couple of years, we've heard endless hysteria about anti-Semitism. And basically any criticism of Israel is reformulated through the lens of anti-Semitism and the Jewish experience as opposed to the liberation of the Palestinian people. Jake, in much of your writing over the last couple of years, you've addressed this relationship really explicitly and have been attempting to kind of flesh out an understanding of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism in a different way, arguing that Zionism is actually perfectly complementary with anti-Semitism, both being forms of kind of psychic pathology. So in this conversation, I'm hoping we can talk about that relationship in an attempt to sort of better understand all of these things, Zionism, anti-Semitism, and US imperialism writ large. I think there's a lot to get through, but I think before we get into the specifics of some of your arguments, could you just tell listeners why you feel it necessary to have a proper account of anti-Semitism in relationship to Zionism? And I suppose in the context of the ongoing genocide, what you think the sort of political urgency of that task is?
Yeah, sure. So so maybe help to go back to kind of like the genesis of this project for me, which started actually way back in 2021. Obviously, it wasn't until a couple of years after that I would start writing about it. But basically, it was during quarantine, right? During the lockdown, COVID lockdown. And I was reading Dialectic of Enlightenment by Doron Horkheimer for the first time. And while I was reading it, there was another, you know, Israeli bombing campaign against Gaza. So I was, you know, I was reading the chapter, Elements of Anti-Semitism, which is how they close the book, while watching this just incredible violence being unleashed upon the Palestinians for, you know, the umpteenth time in my life. And it, you know, if you go back through my physical copy of the book, it's just highlight after highlight, and the margin note just says like Zionism, Israel, because it really was like remarkable reading their explanation of kind of the psychic structure of anti-Semitism and seeing it, you know, play out in this new constellation is the word they use. And like I had, you know, I'm Jewish. I grew up not religious, but my family is very Zionist. And I attended a Jewish day school, kindergarten through 12th grade, which again was not religious, but was very ardently Zionist. And, you know, I was Zionist myself, for, you know, in my teenage years. And so like, I knew very intimately, or I guess know very intimately, like what it's like to feel these things and kind of the not just like the structure of the ideology in an intellectual sense, but also in an affective sense. And the kind of libidinal attachments and things like that that it breeds. And so the like impetus for the project wasn't necessarily really born of, oh, like Zionists are very cynically using anti-Semitism to squash their political enemies, but rather it was, and so then we need to like have a real accounting of what anti-Semitism is to combat that. But it was more just like, or I guess Zionism is itself an expression of the psychic structure of anti-Semitism. It is, you know, both in the crude form of it, bigotry against Jews, which is like certainly a part of anti-Semitism. But when I say anti-Semitism, that's not what I mean. I really am referring to it in the sense of like this manner of thinking that you know, has mutated over the centuries. But the really crucial Adorno Horkheimer quote, if I just read it for a second, is. They write, rage is vented on those who are both conspicuous and unprotected. And just as, depending on the constellation, the victims are interchangeable, vagrants, Jews, Protestants, Catholics, so each of them can replace the murderer in the same blind lust for killing as soon as he feels the power of representing the norm. And so what I mean to draw out there is that anti-Semitism, as colloquially understood, you know, it's a hatred of the Jews, is not really adequate to talking about it, because it is or historically has been that, right? But it doesn't have to be that. The structure can actually just change, or I mean the constellation can change such that any group can be the murderer or the victim. And the thing that I think is really important to do, and what Adorno and Horkheimer were doing in their time, is when this kind of, you know, mode of thought presents itself, and particularly when it like permeates the organs of state, and becomes kind of like this mass delusion that an entire society is taking part in, it inevitably ends up in mass violence. And so drawing out like what is anti-Semitism as it relates to Zionism really doesn't have anything to do with Israel calling itself the Jewish state, although that leads to like certain kinds of like idiosyncrasies and perversions, right? But rather just like we need to do an ideology critique of this entity that is committing genocide. And the way to do it, or one way to do it, and a fruitful way to do it, I think, is we have this incredible literature on kind of on the Nazis and on like classical anti-Semitism, if we could call it that, that drew out like, the psychic structure of it. And that stuff isn't dormant. Like there's nothing, obviously there are specificities about the historical moment. We always need to be thinking in terms of like the concrete object before us, but the analytical framework that they deployed and their insights into how these people think are still very active. And it's because they're still active that I think we're seeing so much of the violence we're seeing right now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, you might not want to talk about this, and we don't have to if you don't want to, but I'm really curious. I didn't realize that you sort of were raised in that background and that you were kind of had Zionist politics until you were a teenager. And the only reason why I ask about that change is because I think it's kind of relevant to what we're going to talk about, in as much as there you're talking about ideology critique, and I think the difference between like an intellectual investment in something and then like a libidinal investment in something, and we could think about those as kind of things that interact but like have really different qualities. Again, you don't have to answer this, Dylan, but do you remember like if there was what kind of shook you out of that, or what was the kind of challenge to that, and how that has kind of informed your thinking about some of the work we're going to talk about now?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it was like a weird and long process, I suppose. So my school, like we our school days are longer, so we graduate early. And we graduate in January instead of in the summer. And in the intervening kind of like 6 months between the graduation and the start of the summer, they take us to Israel for like 4 months, 4 or 5 months. We're gone from like late January to like the beginning of June. And first they take us to Poland for a couple of weeks to like see the concentration camps, and then you land in Jerusalem, and there are the very classic Zionist people like, see, like this is what it was all for, this is what it's all about. And I do think they try to make the Poland part like intentionally miserable. Not, I mean, beyond just like seeing the concentration camps, but like, we were only allowed to eat at kosher restaurants, of which there's like three in Poland, and they're the worst fucking food you can possibly imagine. Everyone lost like 10 pounds during this 2 week trip.
My God.
But in any event, at one of the concentration camps, I think I've written about this before. One of the concentration camps, Majdanek, is, the Nazis didn't really have a chance to destroy it like they did Auschwitz or Treblinka before the advancing Red Army, right? And so it's really like fully intact and like theoretically operational. All the buildings more or less are still standing in their original form. And I remember just having this like really bizarre breakdown and like realization in the gas chamber. You go in the gas chamber, you see the scratches on the walls and like the blue stains from the Zyklon B. And it's really, I mean, it's really a harrowing and horrific experience. And for some reason, what this did to me is I was just like really just like lightning bolt, like struck, like, oh man, like there's actually like no reason that this had to be Jews in here and Germans outside. Like it really could have been any group at any point in history, like doing this to the other. Which is like very much like prefiguring that the Adorno quote that I just read to you. And that was like that didn't like snap me out of anything, because I was like, in addition to being a Zionist, I was also like kind of Republican as well. I was like grew up like kind of right wing kid. It didn't like immediately like change everything overnight, but it was like it's kind of like clearing away, like a clearing of the ground. Like this kind of like move into like historically contingent thinking, as opposed to just like this ontological thinking of like there's something essential about, various groups and the way they act, was really the first nail in the coffin. And then, going to Israel, yeah, it's I look up back on that part of my life with a lot of like conflicted feelings, in the sense of like, at that time I was a Zionist and I was there with all of my friends. We just graduated, we were like allowed to drink, and like it's a wonderful time. It was like really, really fun, because you're kind of in this, you're in this colonial country that was made specifically for you. And but the one thing that like kind of a lot of people left that experience with is like, even though we're like, man, we had such a good time here and like the country's so beautiful, Israelis suck. Like, we all just, we're all like, these guys are like annoying and stupid and like creepy to the girls and like kind of like left a sour taste in our mouths, which again, not enough to stop being a Zionist, but enough to be like, you know, this you're sold this myth of like, oh, this is your home, like this is where you belong, and everyone's like, I don't actually know about that. I don't really think that would be so pleasant. And then, yeah, and then I went to college and I studied philosophy and literally like a right-wing boogeyman style, like read Adorno and then started hating my country and Judaism. But even still, like I became a communist before I became an anti-Zionist, even though like one necessarily implies the other. Yeah, it really was just because like there is such like a taboo. It's like really a third rail that you when you grow up with this stuff, you don't really question it, and it's like so constitutive of your identity. Even when like it not Zionism itself, but the idea of like eternal Jewish victimhood, which we can get into later, I guess, if you want, but like is such an important part of Jewish self-identity that letting go of that and like really, really understanding like the what is happening and has been happening in Palestine, that's a tough thing to let go of. And it really wasn't until I was like 24 that like I wouldn't even consider myself a Zionist, but I would still kind of do the like, well, you know, it's complicated, I'm not so sure about this. All it took is like someone who I love, I was talking to them and they said, you know, actually, I don't really think the situation in Palestine is really all that complicated. It actually seems really easy to me to figure out, you know, who's on the right side and who's on the wrong side. And really just hearing it from someone I love for the first time just really just like snapped me out of it. Really hearing it from anyone at all is the kind of push I needed because I hadn't faced any of that ever before.
I mean, I guess part of why that's so interesting as well is that, like, the work that I wanted to speak to you about, sort of two of the kind of key essays of yours that we're going to talk about appeared in the magazine Pyrapraxis. And earlier in the autumn, a few weeks ago, you finished up a short course with the Psychosocial Foundation called Zionism as an Antisemitism. And I suppose why I think those things are related is because obviously both the magazine and that foundation and your work as a part of it are invested in grasping a sort of psychosocial account of these things. And that is a kind of, you know, that term will mean different things to different people, but essentially it's like, can you think both materially and psychically about various political phenomena? And I guess, you know, before we get into some more of the nuts and bolts of what anti-Semitism is, what Zionism is, et cetera, I wanted to ask you a bit about, I mean, firstly, like how the course went, how the conversations developed in that short course. I think it'd be also really interesting to hear a little bit more about the materials you draw on for the seminar. You've already talked a little bit about the Frankfurt School and Horkheimer and Adorno specifically, but also, I guess, especially, I'd love to hear you say a little bit about the importance of the psychic dimension, the psychosocial dimension to thinking through some of these questions in a way that maybe speaks to what you've said there about how they're kind of hard, they're difficult to parse, these kind of libidinal material questions and kind of the way in which these experiences that shape our politics are kind of overdetermined in different ways. So, I mean, there's a few things there, but yeah, tell listeners about the course that you did and how it went.
The course was, I think it went great. I mean, you'd have to ask the people who took it what they thought, but everyone seemed to really enjoy it, and I thought it was really generative and nice. But it really like kind of it grew out in large part from that first essay, the big one I wrote for Pyrapraxis, Elements of Anti-Semitism. And like the structure, that essay was to kind of draw what we've been talking about, that Zionism is an anti-Semitism, and in specifically the psychosocial sense that we've been discussing, and then proceeding through like a series of sketches in just like drawing out like different elements of the way it's, you know, the ideology and the way it manifests and how they participate in that same logic, and doing it through like you know, talking about paranoia in one part, like talking about the kinds of like Palestinian as bad capitalist, which is like a kind of inversion of like the Jew as capitalist. Yeah, talking about like the blood and soil, like racial elements, you know, these kind of like stabs from different directions. And so the course kind of followed a similar structure. I mean, so it was only four classes, and we started with like a discussion of the Adorno and Horkheimer, and to a lesser degree, this essay, Notes on Antisemitism by Werner Bonefeld, which is quite good, but like a lot of Germans, he ends up just being a Zionist, which also is, in fact, is like also true of Adorno and especially Horkheimer, who had this like a horrific reactionary turn later in life. But, you know, a lot of these guys that we were discussing just like are Zionists, or were Zionists. And it's, I think, like, I know it's interesting that they don't follow the content of their own theory to its conclusion. And, you know, there's for Durham Horkheimer, there were like political reasons, and like they're in a way like were afraid of any like positive project. And then Horkheimer became just like reactionary, like anti-Soviet guy, because he was so freaked out by the what he thought of like Soviet kind of like totalitarianism, stuff like that. But whatever. Anyway, so that was the first class. And the second one was, we were talking about kind of this like racial blood and soil element, and like the Israeli nation state law, and like the construction of Jews like as not like co-religionists, but as like a race, as like, and like tied specifically to like a race that can only be like realized its like racial makeup in the land of Palestine in like a real like blood and soil type way. And then we did a class on torture, which I just wrote a long thing on. And that one, I guess, a little more explanation for why I thought that was so important is there's like this it's a really wonderful essay by Jean Emery, who was a Holocaust survivor, called Torture, in which he, you know, describes his own torture by the Gestapo in Belgium. And he says this like interesting thing where he's like, you know, torture was not just like a tactic of National Socialism, but it was its essence. And he spends the essay like kind of drawing that out. And I think a rather like unsatisfactory way, but it like really points towards a lot of interesting conclusions. And, you know, the Israelis are and have been like really some of the world's most prolific torturers. It is really like basically everyone who passes through those prisons gets tortured in one way or another. And since October 7th, we've seen that kind of like really go into hyperdrive with these like in the like horrific like concentration camps of State Teman and like Ofer prison, where they're just really, you know, like all manner of violence. And so I really want to explore like whether that conclusion that he reached could be applied to the situation in Palestine as well. And so for that, like, you know, there's Jean Emery, but then there was also this incredible essay by Walid Daka, who's Palestinian political prisoner and writer, who was martyred recently, like last year, I think, called Consciousness Molded. Excellent. And then a bunch of essays in this really great book that I've been recommending to everyone called Threat, which is Palestinian political prisoner writing, and like writing about Palestinian political prisoners, or just prisoners in general, that has a lot of like fantastic essays by and about the prisons on the prison movement. And then the last class was about like kind of why so much of this violence has taken on this really bizarre and horrific like sexual dimension. You know, we're thinking like the looting of underwear that you saw like a ton of when they were really rampaging through Gaza before the kind of like consolidation phase, where, you know, they would just break into people's homes and like steal their underwear and like wear it, like display it as trophies, and also like, of course, like the horrific like mass rape that the IDF has been perpetrating both within and outside the prisons, and like the forced nudity and the stripping of Palestinian men that happens whenever they're taken captive. You know, it seemed to me like something very much worth exploring. In that one, we were drawing again from like Essays in Threat, from Dialectic of Enlightenment again, Klaus Telleleit, you know, Male Fantasies. I think it's like a pretty good text for this. Again, another German who is in fact a Zionist and who recently gave this really gross interview, actually. I think
did he actually? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he sees in Hamas the kind of like figure of the Freikorps that he was talking about, but he's got it like exactly wrong.
Right. Yeah.
I guess I don't know if it's fair to call him anti-Deutsch. I'm not that invested in German politics because they're so like,
yeah.
Because like, what's there to do there? You know. But it was, yeah, it was just like this gross bad interview that a lot of these guys have been giving. And then also like this obviously participates as well in the kind of like machismo and sexist and misogynist elements within Israeli society itself. Yeah, that was the course. And if there was a, I can't remember if you asked a second question in relation.
No, I mean, I guess the question, I think you kind of answered it, but it was just, you know, like why, I guess it's just about the importance of like apprehending these questions in a way that can account for both the sort of material and the psychic aspects of
Okay,
them. I
yeah.
think I think you've kind of answered it. I mean,
I can answer one more thing on that, I guess. Is that like a lot of the things that Israel is doing are in like certainly like in the short term, like really damaging to the country. And I don't just mean in the sense of like losing like international legitimacy or anything like that, although that's kind of part of it because the world is kind of moving into a place where that stuff doesn't really matter. But also just like economically, the war has been really devastating for them. And like they use a lot of like Palestinian labor in construction and agriculture, and like those industries really intensely contracted. You know, the GDP contracted. There have been like, you know, trade consequences, though not nearly as many as there should be, and like their credit rating was downgraded, things like that. And so the drive for like colonizing not only Palestine but also like greater Israel, as they call it, can't, I think, really fully be explained through like these like very like crude materialist factors alone. Like it's not like they want the land in like the farms in the West Bank because they're such economic powerhouses. There really is like this kind of psychotic ideological dimension that's driving a lot of the action, and unless you know, pay close attention to it, you're really going to get an incomplete picture of what's happening and why.
I think just to add to that as well as like a reader is so much of, I mean, not just in the last few years, much longer than that, but especially in Britain, it's felt like so many of the discourses around Palestine and anti-Semitism that has been kind of globbed onto those discussions in a way that we'll talk about. It like it feels like a form of kind of psychic or like informational warfare, you know, like I don't know how kind of aware you are of this history here, but in Britain, one of the main weapons that was used to undermine the left throughout the period in which Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party was accusations of anti-Semitism. And I
Yeah.
think a lot of people listening to this, like, even though they know it intellectually, that Zionism is consistent with anti-Semitism in all the ways that we're about to get into, there will be there may well be a sense of, I think you used the term like third rail before, like, oh shit, like this. You can feel a sense of programming that you've been subject to kind of being challenged and being undone. And yeah, I don't know, as a reader, that kind of psychic element I think speaks very explicitly to that experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Okay, so I think at the risk of asking you like a very like basic question, but you used this quote from Horkheimer and Adorno earlier, talking about anti-Semitism as a kind of constellation. You know, you also use the phrase kind of psychic structure or a sort of manner of thinking. And I want you to just explain anti-Semitism to me, like I'm a complete idiot. Like, so, you know, how you know, how do we start to kind of apprehend this thing that is anti-Semitism in a way that isn't just being mean to Jewish people? Specifically, like, how does anti-Semitism constitute a way of producing, quote unquote, the Jew as an object of fantasy?
Well, I think you really kind of touched on the essential element right there in terms of like the production of the Jew as an object of fantasy, or the production of the enemy as an object of fantasy, because we should be decoupling it from Judaism. But like, you know, like Zionism, or not Zionism, anti-Semitism, or Zionism, anti-Semitism, right? Anti-Semitism is a like a form of racism, like it's a form of racialist thinking, right? But it's also its own kind of thing. So like there's a family likeness there. And so what I think is like the distinguishing element, and I want to be careful here. I'm not trying to like exceptionalize again like the Jewish experience as somehow worse or more violent or more worthy of attention than other forms of racism. It's just like the structure of anti-Semitism is the one that I think is much more at play than a more like traditional just like colonial racism, although of course there's a lot of that as well. And so what I think is like the really distinguishing factor, in addition to all the things they have in common, is this element of paranoia and false projection, and like the primacy of those two things in the kind of like psychic structure. And so what I mean by false projection is, Adorno and Horkheimer talk about the way that like cognition should generally work is like there's you like approach the outside world, like there's external reality, and it you like incorporate it somehow into yourself, and you return yourself to it via like judgments, and this kind of interplay between what's happening internal to you and what's happening with the outside world, and the distance between them is a way of like constituting the self and like the ordinary kind of like way of thinking. What false projection is that like you, instead of incorporating or approaching the outside world as like this kind of like opaque thing of resistance that you need to then interact with, it's you make outside reality resemble yourself. And this is like, it's, I guess, like to make an example, is like when the very popular phrase, like, every accusation is a confession that people say about Zionists is largely true. And that's just another way of saying false projection, that like urges and motivations and desires and, energies that the subject like cannot themselves avow get projected outwards onto other objects, other subjects. And then they're like perceived as a threat, right? So like my like anxious like death drive energy is like I don't want them. They're freaking me out. And so I project them outwards as a way of like psychic self-defense mechanism. And then now they're on you, and you're invested with all this horrible stuff inside me, and I perceive you as persecuting me. But right, like, and so like this kind of there's like an emptiness that grows around the subject, because everything becomes just an empty repetition of what's inside me, right? The external world loses its texture, loses its actual qualities, and becomes really nothing more than like this repeating and deepening delusion that I'm constructing at all times. And so this like inevitably kind of thing manifests in paranoia, which we should understand is like an interpretation mania. It's a way of bringing everything in external reality under like a single heading, which is like the heading of my delusion, the heading of threat, And this is part of the false projection. It's like because things lose their actual character, it's not that like, oh, you're a person with your own internal world. Actually, no, you're a threat to me because I've invested you with like these threatening ideas. And that's the way, that's the filter through which external reality is now passing. Which is again just like a repetition of the things that are inside me. But this isn't like, we think of like this like kind of persecution mania, and we see it like manifesting really intensely with Zionists, where they really think everyone is out to get them. And there's a cynical element of that for sure. I mean, this is like very like the cynical deployment of anti-Semitism and seen in every like Palestinian march. Like another Kristallnacht, right? Like they're certainly like a very intentional, cynical, like we are trying to delegitimize our enemies kind of thing. But the thing that, like just like my experience of growing up in this world that I think is important for people to grasp is like a lot of these people like really do believe this. They like really do feel under attack. And they really are genuinely frightened. And of course, they're genuinely frightened of the phantoms in their own head, but the fear itself is genuine. It just has nothing to do with the actual object. And the move that happens is that this kind of persecution mania and this kind of paranoia, one would think that like, oh, I feel like I'm under attack all the time, and so like I feel powerless, blah, blah, blah. But it's actually, and Adorno and Horkheimer draw this out, I think, very well, is like it's actually the feeling, it's not a feeling of smallness, but a feeling of omnipotence. Which is that everything is now under my heading. Everything in the world kind of has to belong to me. I'm kind of directing the picture. And even though everything is like is threatening me, I'm actually making everything in the world an image of my own likeness. It's like as if I was a god, right? And so there's an attraction there as well, which is it actually like this feeling of threat actually manifests as very much a feeling of power, a feeling of omnipotence. And there's like, and so, the for the very like the individual like paranoiac, right? The individual like asocial or antisocial actor in this way, like eventually reality is going to return itself to you and make you stop because you're behaving in this like pathic way that threatens people, right? But if you can build up a league, right? If you can build up an organization in which you are all sharing the delusion, then that one like confirms it in other people who are participating in this kind of like same emptiness as you are. But it also gives you something very powerful, which is both the ability and the license to reify these fears, to create an enemy and attack that enemy. And it gives you license to commit violence. And this violence that you perpetrate on who you perceive to be the persecuting other kind of confirms your delusion at every turn, right? By torturing someone or by killing the Palestinian, it's not their violence against you that constitutes them as a threat, because you've already done that in the first instance. It's your violence against them which confirms your idea of them as a threat, because only like the threatening person is the one on whom you can use violence, right? So it's like this kind of circular logic that emerges. And so when I talk about anti-Semitism, of course there's also elements regarding like a fear of modernity and like a fear of like kind of in the 20th century, like of like the Jew being emancipated and now like entering the body politic, and so I get a lot of like this like hygienic and like virus like metaphor and stuff. And there's like an idea of like preserving this kind of like internal homogeneity and purity, which is again, I think, also itself a manifestation of this like pathic false projection and paranoia, which is like there can only be me, there can only be the self, and so like the other as such becomes a threat because everything gets invested with that paranoia, right? But really, like, so again, there's a million little threads here, and a lot of them are like self-contradictory, like any kind of like fascism, right? But it's really that paranoia and that false projection that I think are kind of the sine qua non of anti-Semitism that I think course through everything else, every other way it manifests.
Yeah, I mean, I think that contradiction is actually important to hone in on as well. I think like people listening will be very familiar with the dynamic whereby people, whether they be Zionists or fascists, I mean, interchangeable, describe their enemies as both kind of pathetic, weak, useless, while simultaneously being the gravest threat possible to humanity and to their safety and being in control of all these kind of secret levers of society. Could you just kind of just maybe just to follow on there, like just say a little bit about the way in which the kind of contradiction is the point, in that it allows contradictory kind of feelings and drives to be projected outward so as not to be resolved?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just hit it on it right there. Is that there's a bunch of like there's a bunch of contradictory drives that are within you that are being projected outward, and they can't be resolved. But then there's also like in like the racial element that the Zionists have constructed, right? Like it's all kind of operating as like a way of like the negative image through which they constitute themselves is not as against the Palestinians, but rather as against like the diaspora of Jew. Like Begin and Ben Gurion have these like really nasty quotes where they're talking about, the Jew with trembling knees who's like shamed the nation. These are the people who died in the Holocaust, right? And there's like Hebrew slang for Holocaust survivors or sabonim, which means like soap, right? Or like and like coward. And so what they're trying to do with like the new Hebrew, it's was it like Nordau who wrote about this? Max Nordau talked about like muscular Judaism and like the new Jew, and it really was like this internalization of like anti-Semitic stereotypes about Jewish people as like weak and effete and like only really suited to the money trade. And we're like, no, we need to actually reject all that and kind of become the image of our oppressor, and become like strong, and we need to like work the soil. And they're right that we are this distinct race, but we need to like embrace this like racialist ideology and become the negative image of what they believe us to be. And if you look at like early kind of Zionist propaganda of the Holocene, the pioneers, you see these like brawny, like literally blonde guys, like working the soil of Palestine and like building it up. And there's like an incredible just like hatred and disgust at weakness, right? And that like gets projected onto like, basically everyone who was not a Zionist, like all the European Jews, the Yiddish world. But this like hatred and disgust of weakness, it's just like any of your enemies, like you revile them, and you revile them in their weakness, and in their weakness is confirmed by your murder of them, and it's also the occasion for your murder, right? It, like seeing any kind of weakness, and weakness here is not just like actual kind of like these physical characteristics, but also like any kind of drive to like not do violence is considered to be weak. Any kind of like intermixing is weak. Like the self needs to be this like impenetrable fortress. And so like engagement with the other is like a sign of weakness, right? And so you see your enemy who was not trying to take like exclusive and self-segregating ownership of the land, like that's weak, and that they must be like exterminated, because they also are like invested with all this kind of like self-hatred. Like when you talk about weakness, that is like a form of like Zionist self-hatred being cast out, right? So there's that element to it, which is like very tied up in like the construction of this new like macho Jewish race. But then of course, like anything which is other, anything which is like opposing you as not yourself is a threat. And so on the one hand, these people are weak because the Zionist like thinks they're gross and despises them and despises the like kind of like reflection, almost like utopic reflection of like coexistence, or the possibility of like existence with the other, but that is also simultaneously very threatening, because it's something outside, and everything outside has become a threat. And so like that kind of contradictory nature, like they're both just like held completely at once, and they don't really rub against each other in this way that might generate reflection.
In some of your writing, you use this language of inversion and Zionism being an inversion of some of the precepts of classical anti-Semitism or sort of Nazi anti-Semitism, European anti-Semitism. And one of the examples you used that really clarified it for me was, related to what you were just saying, was around ideas of sort of blood and soil, around like claims about nationhood and the land. So on the one hand, we have National Socialism making these claims about the Jew as being immutably different on like a racial basis from the Aryan race, and therefore needing to be cast out. But then on the other hand, we can see that within Zionism, that there's kind of a repetition of that, in as much as they're also trying to defend the kind of immutable racial or ethnic distinctiveness of the Jewish people, quote unquote, to also make claims about the land, specifically land in West Asia, the lands in Palestine and other sort of neighboring countries. So just to kind of unpack that a little bit, could you say a little bit more about this sort of blood and soil politics, specifically how ideas of sort of racial homogeneity, we can kind of see that operating in both anti-Semitism and Zionism and kind of in an inversion of each other. Can you just kind of unpick that for people?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't think it's an inversion of the one. I think it's just a direct continuation, right? Like,
okay,
yeah. I mean, there are like inversions that take place, but I don't think this is one of them. Which is to say, like, this like racialist thinking, which is again like itself a form of false projection, but like participates in it, in which like there's an endless repetition of the self that needs to take place at the expense of like any kind of direct intercourse with the external world and the other, and like it forces people into these kind of like deluded groups, which need to maintain this kind of like complete homogeneity as a way of like protecting the like one, just like the like closed fortress of the self, which then becomes like the closed fortress of the group, but also the kind of like capacity for that endless repetition, which can admit no external world. But like the blood, it's so like the blood and soil part is really interesting, because Nadia Abu El-Haj has this cool book called The Genealogical Science. in which he talks about like the like genealogical testing in Israel. And one of the things she says is that like, you know, in like very, very early Israel, like they were like, okay, the Jew is a race and there's like a homogeneity there. But like they're just simply, there was not like you had guys from Poland or like, you know, assimilated Jews from Germany now meeting for the first time in the 50s, like Jews from Yemen and like Arab Jews, right? And like whom they just like didn't share a language. They like barely shared religion. Like they did certainly didn't share a culture. And there was like also like massive just like phenotypic difference. Everyone looked very dissimilar. And so the way that that kind of difference was bridged was through genetic testing. It was like, oh, actually there's something like internal to the blood that binds you, which is itself like kind of like more allegedly empirical form of just like 19th century race science. But like the thing is like that only becomes like an activated project on, or like gets its urgency from the colonization of Palestine, right? There's no reason, and there's no, and like historically they weren't doing this, like saying like, oh, these people are all like related by blood. There was no, that didn't, like, who cares, unless you're like constructing this kind of like national project in which racial self-segregation is like Fayez Sayegh puts it, right? Like is kind of like the core of what you're trying to do, right? And so you need to construct the race. There needs to be like something to self-segregate around. There needs to be like, you need to start constructing in the boundaries of your polity such that it can exclude, you know, Muslim and Christian Arabs who look just like Jewish Arabs, right? Like it needs to exclude them on some basis. And the way you're doing it is not, again, like it is blood that like gets its meaning from the like ownership of the land. You know, there's very much a sense coursing through Zionism that like Jews who don't live in Israel are like inchoate Jews, or like they haven't quite, they're not like quite participating in it correctly. And of course you can like salvage this if you're like a really hardcore Zionist or hardcore nationalist and you believe yourself to be part of this like national racial makeup. But if you're just like an anti-Zionist Jew, there is this kind of sense that like, oh, you're not really Jewish, because you may have the blood element, which like will grant you that, but the blood needs to be like activated by participation in this like national, in this national project. And yeah, I mean, that's like very much like consistent with just, you know, 20th century anti-Semitism. I mean, like Werner Bonefeld talks about, he calls it like anti-Semite equality. And it's like there's an equality that like comes through ownership, right? That we all own the land. We're all like together, like in the kind of engaged in the same project of like dominating this land and excluding the other. And like this kind of project of ownership is also just a way of constituting the race, right? Which is to say there's the blood element, but then you become part of like the Volk, right? Like the national racial project through the act of domination. And that's kind of how you become legible to everyone else within the project is, oh, you're also engaged in it. You also have this equality of ownership. So like the anti-Zionist Jew in America or in Europe or wherever becomes kind of like illegible as a Jew, not just because, right, like they're not nationalists, which is kind of what that has become coextensive with in the Zionist imagination, right? But also they're just like not, they're not engaging in that project of colonial domination, which is how everyone becomes recognizable to the other one. And this like has, like I ended an essay with this, but like it has these like weird results, right? Where you have like in Miami a few months ago, that guy, that Zionist who shot two Israelis because he thought they were Palestinians. Right. And they like forgave him. they like forgave him. And then like in their like statement about being shot, they said like death to the Arabs. Right.
Just insane shit.
Yeah. But like, that's the thing, is like outside of that colonial context, outside of like the actual act of domination, it's easy to confuse people. And you stop being legible to one another. And so like blood and soil are not like, I don't know. I think we can think about them separately, but really it's like, the one gives meaning to the other, and they exist like in this permanent kind of linkage.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned Nadia Abou-El-Hajj as well. Her work is, I feel like not enough people read it.
Yeah,
and,
she's incredible.
She's really great. Okay. I mean, I think I want to come back to this idea that you raised earlier, and you kind of raised throughout your work about the kind of decoupling. And I mean, maybe it kind of links to this idea of where there's consistency and where there's like inversion. So, it, as you argue, anti-Semitism is this kind of actually much more malleable structure than people might otherwise believe, or is kind of claimed in many kind of mainstream discourses. Could you say a bit more about some of the examples of what you see as inversions? Because I think that will offer us a way into thinking about when we say that this is malleable, how it's being put to work specifically in the context of the subjugation and colonization of the Palestinian people. I mean, am I right in, my memory's really shit today, but am I right in thinking that the kind of the idea of the Palestinian as the bad capitalist you would see as a kind of inversion of the Jew in kind of Nazi Germany as being a too competent capitalist?
Yeah, for sure. So I think that, yeah, I think that's like an important inversion where like, yeah, in like 20th century and like 19th century, whatever, like older European anti-Semitism is against the Jews, right? Part of the issue that they had was like the Jew is like this avatar of abstraction and like as like avatar of capital, right? Like you know, they can confine them to like the money trades, and like kind of they fulfill this important like economic function, but were themselves also at the same time like outside of the rest of the economy and like outside of the body politic. And then with like kind of enlightenment reforms, as they started to like get emancipated and like allowed into the body politic proper, right? Like that was a kind of like disorienting experience of the outside coming in and this like, you know, community turning into society, like as constituted through like abstract rules instead of just like blood and land ties. And then also like they were the avatar, like they're entering the world at the same time as like, you know, capitalism is, you know, all that is solid is melting into air, and like all of the like former social relations are being replaced and subsumed by capitalist relations. And they kind of became associated with that. So there was this kind of like intense dislocating moment, and then all of that kind of like fear and paranoia as a result of that, and like all of that anxiety got cast onto the Jew, right? And now what you're seeing is something like kind of different. Like we've been living with capitalism now for quite a while, and it really is like both like materially and ideologically triumphant. It's the world in which we live, and it's the way in which we understand things. And the charge of like, oh, you're a capitalist, like kind of doesn't really carry any negative valence anymore.
Yeah.
Now everyone's like, yeah, that's great. Like, oh, I'm good at making money. Thank you. And of course there's some elements of this in like the right wing talking about like globalists and stuff like that as like the dislocations of like global capital, but they're not really against capital as such. And you see this like constant, like the way that the Zionists and like, we'll talk about the Palestinians as these people who have like insufficiently integrated themselves into capitalist modernity, and are like kind of like going against the current in a certain way. And they'll use like a horrific like racial terms to talk about this and be like, oh, well, they're just like biologically stupid and like incapable of doing these things. Of course, obviously not the case. And there's some like, you know, like Lockean colonial elements there of like, oh, the Palestinians haven't like sufficiently mixed their labor with the land, which in the present context means like creating like financial institutions and heavy industries, kind of like actual like abstract institutions. And so it's like a terra nullius in a way, right? And like that was like part of also like the making the desert bloom isn't that like, oh, the Palestinians didn't have agriculture, but rather that like they didn't have European agriculture. They weren't like doing things, they were doing things that were like actually just like inconsistent with the ecosystem and like kind of wreaking havoc through like afforestation efforts, things like that. And like you saw in this, like that horrible ad that played like during the Super Bowl this year, I think, in which it was like AI, like imagining of Gaza as like Abu Dhabi, like, oh, yeah. like the Palestinians had failed to turn Gaza into this kind of like Western wonderland. And so we need to kill them and rectify that waste. And so, yeah, there's this element of like, they're like the Palestinians in the Zionist imaginary as like this image of the bad capitalist that has like the colonial balance, but also as like this this group that as a result, and like again, like part of there being the bad capitalists and like not having the heavy industry, the financial institutions, is the direct result of like Israeli domination and like complete like strangulation on Palestinian economic prospects, right? But there's an element in which they're like going against the current and kind of presenting this unsettling image of a people who like are actually in kind of the same way through different like a different economic valence, like presenting the image of the universal, which is to say that like part of like capitalist, like part of the way it like structures the subject is this like all against all thinking. There's almost a Hobbesian right thinking. And Adorno and Horkheimer also like kind of identify instrumental reason, which is like thinking of everyone as like inputs and, you know, like cost benefit, whatever. One as like kind of the way in which the Nazis were thinking during the Shoah, but also itself as a form of paranoia and false projection, right? It is the turning of everything in the external world into a thing, like assimilating it under a single heading and stripping it of its qualities and turning it into quantities, right? And so already like just in capitalist modernity, like false projection and paranoia are like kind of the way that thought is working in the general sense. And of course, with the Zionists and anti-Semitism, it takes on this like much more intense, like persecutory and violent character. But so like anyone who's like a bad capitalist, even like against their own will, or even if that image has been cast onto them, that image like suggests a kind of a way of like non-instrumental reason, so a way of being and of thinking, which does not view the world as this like endless and destructive competition, and does not participate in the kind of all against all war of like ever, which, you know, in the geopolitical sense is like ever increasing particularity and like the nation, literally just the nation state of, and like nation states pitched against one another in this kind of, yeah, in this kind of like world system in which the like universal the Zionists are trying to realize is like the universal will to domination and the universal will to segregation. And that stuff is going on. And there's also a sense in which like the capitalist, or just like the Enlightenment project, is one of like the domination of nature, which culminates in this kind of instrumental reason. And to say that someone is the bad capitalist, right, is to be like, well, you actually are like not dominating nature enough. You're actually like insufficiently an Enlightenment subject. And you are like acting like an animal, right? Like human animal is like another way of saying this bad capitalist thing, and vice versa, which is also another way of saying like, you can exist for me as raw material, as something that is filth, that like is there to be destroyed and is there to be dominated. And if you weren't, like if you were acting like a good capitalist, if you were participating in this like same like project of domination, then that would be a different story. But because, oh, actually you're not good at it, you'd have no aptitude for it, you are like nature itself, and nature is, again, like nature is filth, nature is there to be molded and dominated, and when it's not useful, it's there to be destroyed.
I want to ask you about, I think, maybe a kind of an interesting tension about how we talk about this stuff. And I suppose the way into that might be to think a little bit about, I mean, again, to talk about this seems like it's very heavy topics in a way that I think I'll come back to. But you talk about the Shoah there, and, you know, we're talking about theorists who've offered a kind of analysis of anti-Semitism, partly a result of trying to make sense of their experience of living through the Nazi Holocaust. And you have this line, I can't remember which one of the essays, the Parapraxis essay is in, but you have this line where you write that the colonization of Palestine, which began prior to the Shoah, becomes retroactively justified and even motivated by the Shoah itself. And I think we have this situation that, like, a lot of listeners will be familiar with, that if you start to talk about the genocide in Gaza, you know, if you say it in the wrong environment, you know, online, or, you know, it's not impossible, you know, in a sense, it's kind of likely that someone will potentially call you a Nazi, potentially accuse you of justifying the Holocaust itself, or inviting another one, or denying Al-Aqsa flood as a version of the Holocaust. And I suppose the tension that I'm trying to identify is that these things are globbed together. These different historical events are kind of globbed together in like less than helpful ways. And in a sense, I take your work on this topic is about trying to put them in relation to each other in a way that is more historically clear, but then also kind of part of a sort of broader political struggle over what these different historical and contemporary developments mean. And I suppose the question I want to ask is like, there's this tension, right, between needing an account of all these things in terms of European anti-Semitism, National Socialism, the Shoah, and their relationship to the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the colonization of Palestine. But of course, central to the process of colonization is to kind of have the Palestinian as peripheral to a story of the Jewish experience. And in this country, as in the US, very often conversations around Palestine, the terms of that debate are not set on the terms of Palestinian liberation or solidarity with Palestinians. They're usually policed by an idea of offense or an, you know, the risk of anti-Semitism, like going back to that phrase that people have heard of, like, oh yeah, anti-Zionism always veers into anti-Semitism. The idea that the terrain of the debate is set by the kind of hurt feelings of Jewish Zionists. And so I suppose in your work, like thinking through all these questions, I wanted to ask you sort of how you think about keeping those things in correspondence in a way where you don't feel like you're sort of replicating that dynamic. Like how do you think through that stuff when you do your writing and when you're kind of having conversations like this?
Yeah. So just like in reference to that, that quote in which you began, it's from the essay Idée Fixe. I actually yes. not sure how I pronounce that. I just like glommed from a, from an Adorno quote about paranoia. but it's like the dynamic there is really interesting. I think really telling about like the blood and soil element, right? Which is that what you've kind of like seen happen is, if in like Zionist like historicity and the Zionist imagination, right, like the colonization of Palestine and the founding of the state of Israel was the like was salvation from the Shoah. Mm-hmm. Right? The Shoah like demonstrated the need for exclusive like Jewish sovereignty over a place, and Jews fleeing to Palestine during that time was the thing which saved them. And therefore, like, it's the thing that both kind of like, it's like retroactively justified by the Shoah, of course. And I say retroactive because obviously the colonization started well before then. And Zionism started well before then. And is also the thing that like saved world Jewry, right? And will continue saving it in perpetuity, right? And so this kind of like retroactive justification kind of rebounds against the Palestinians. We're like, okay, the Palestinians are the ones who are trying to deny this exclusive Jewish sovereignty over their land. And when that land itself, when sovereign exclusive sovereignty itself is salvation, then the people who are challenging you, and not even just challenging you by trying to like kick you out, but even just trying to like coexist with you on the land, or to right, like they're like retroactively also like transubstantiated into Nazis, into people who are trying to like carry on and complete and continue the Nazi project, which was one of basically like denying you, like of killing you, but also like denying you this kind of like self-determination. And so you get these like insane instances of like Netanyahu saying that like, you know, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was actually the one who like told Hitler to do the Final Solution. Right? Like, which is like in any other like instance, they would really instantly recognize that it's like a form of Holocaust denial. But of course, right? Like, but like, it's really symptomatic of the way in which they're thinking about Palestinians, like not only as just like, oh, like anyone who is an anti-Semite, like we inflate the threat, of course, anti-Semite in quotes, right? Like we inflate the threat to the point where everyone becomes the image of Hitler. And this is like symptomatic of my paranoia, right? But it's also no, like we really do identify them as like carrying on that same Nazi project because of these kind of like weird, like retroactive transubstantiations that we're going through in terms of like Zionism and blood and soil, like as salvation, right? So yeah, so like that's one thing, which is not exactly what you're asking about, but which I think is interesting. We're trying out, But then, yeah, so in terms of like the there is a like I want to like I'm always like really cognizant of that risk, right? Of like that when talking about these things and using these texts to talk about what's happening now, that there is like kind of a risk of recapitulating that Jewish supremacist or just like Western frame of like Palestinian suffering or like colonial suffering only becomes legible through discussion or through reference to the suffering of Europeans, right? And I want to say that's like not, at least I'm really trying not to do that. I really hope that I don't think that's what I'm doing, and I don't think people think that's what I'm doing, but I
No, I
want
didn't.
to, I'm really not trying to do that. And that like the use of these texts isn't like in a like strict like comparative way, and it's not to say that like we can only, oh, like these people are suffering and they're suffering like the Jews, right? That's not what I'm saying, because the actual like correspondence is not between the victims, but between the perpetrators, which is that the Zionists are behaving very much ideologically like the Nazi settlers, and it's important to stress the Nazis were settlers. They were enacting a continent-wide project of settler colonialism on Europe. And with the attendant extermination, right? They're acting like that. And so it's not that Palestinian suffering becomes legible by reference to Jewish suffering in the Shoah, but rather Zionist ideology is illuminated by reference to the Nazis before them. And of course, there's differences. And the part of like any like good, I think, comparative project like that is illuminating what those differences are, and like how, and like approaching, again, approaching the object as it is and approaching the time as it is, and not saying, oh, this is exactly like that, but rather that there's a similar psychic structure at play that can help us understand it. And just the wealth of literature about it happens to be from people who were making sense of the Shoah. There's of course also an exceptionalization of the Shoah and the understanding of it, especially in Zionist thought, but also in just in the Western imaginary in general, as like this singular event that has kind of that like at once like stands in for universal suffering, but it can only, but only by like self-reference, right? Like you can only understand universal suffering if you're referencing it to the Holocaust, and only because like the Jews suffered the most, right? And that's like all suffering that happens has to be in relation to that in like a matter of like degree, right? And that yields like really kind of like bad history and like bad understanding of people saying, oh, the lesson of the Holocaust is like that, like to the extent there is a lesson, right? It's not, it didn't happen to teach us anything, but like we need to like learn from historical reality, is that like, oh, anti-Semitism is real and threatening, rather than like national racial thinking. When it becomes an expansive project, like will always result in this kind of like horrific violence. And we saw that in like seeing it as like a continuation of like European colonial violence. And of course attending to the differences that occurred. But like what I also like want to do and like want to stress through like using these texts is thinking of the Shoah as in terms of this like historical continuity, which doesn't strip any of these like genocides of their singularity, but rather like places them as like singular points on a single line, if that makes sense. Right. So it's not that like everything needs to be made by reference to the Shoah, but like actually any one of these things could kind of stand in for the universal barbarity that history has been so far. Right. The Nakba can stand in for that. The genocidal violence in the Vietnam War, or like the colonial violence against by the Belgians against people in the Congo, right? Like the extermination of the American Indies, like all of these things refer to one another, and all of them refer back to history, and all of them are in their own way singular. So again, like yeah, like the project is not that oh, like all of these things only become legible in reference to Jewish suffering, but rather all of these things help to illuminate the single like catastrophic march of history and the conditions which have made all of these things possible and continue to make them possible.
Yeah. You recently had this piece in The Nation that was really good, and I thought it might be a way to kind of close out this conversation and maybe kind of offer a way forward on a way to take forward some of the things we've been discussing. And the article I'm thinking of is the one you had in The Nation, where you're addressing this series of drone strikes being carried out by the US government against small boats off the coast of Venezuela in the Caribbean. And in that piece, you argue that we're moving beyond a kind of existing liberal international order that you concede in, like, I agree that, you know, as flawed and hypocritical and as damaging as that liberal order always was, we are, I think, moving into sort of something different, or at least that's being transformed in some way. Central to that change is a figure that has been kind of running through this whole conversation, which is the figure of the terrorist. Very often in the sort of American European imaginary, that is a Muslim/Arab terrorist, the figure of the kind of alien other that was once filled by the Jew in different contexts that we've been talking about throughout this whole discussion. And I suppose the question I want to ask you about is how you feel like some of the things we've discussed already feed into this change. I mean, you, like, in the work that you do elsewhere with the Hind Rajab Foundation, are incredibly cognizant of the global nature of Zionism and the kind of imperial boomerang effect that is taking place of soldiers, the sort of Zionist forces circulating globally, going to different places, people traveling to so-called Israel to fight in the IDF and then kind of come back and feed those experiences into other reactionary movements. So I suppose the question is, could you just sort of describe this change that you outline in that article, like what you think that transformation is made up of and where you see Zionism as a project and as an ideology operating in that change?
Yeah. So the change that I was trying to outline there is the, like, U.S. like imperialism and like hegemony in the world system is like kind of just like on the way out in terms of like its kind of like de facto economic monopoly on the world. That's just gone. Like, that's just a foregone conclusion. That's going away. And what we're seeing, or what we saw in like the Cold War, was like the U.S. really trying to shore up its domination. And in a sense, it kind of won, because the Soviet Union was destroyed and was able to kind of run really just like roughshod over the rest of the world in a way, and like perpetrate all of these like horrible like neocolonial genocides, or assist in various genocides as a part of this imperial project. But there was still this like, and I want to like be careful here, because something that like happens when you say this stuff is everyone's like, oh, like, no, actually the world's always been bad. And it's like, yeah, it has always been bad. That is very true. But it can always get worse. And it's going to get worse. Which is that, like, after World War II, right, like, the, like, international law and the international legal system as we know it came into being. Like, Geneva Conventions were signed, the Genocide Convention was created, the United Nations was created, and things, like, of course, this didn't really rein in the imperial violence that the U.S. was going to do. I mean, it was only, like, what, like, 2 years after the Geneva Conventions and, like, Genocide Convention that the U.S. was destroying every extant structure in North Korea, right? Through this like horrible campaign of bombing, and then like, you know, 10 years after that, 13 years after that, like going to Vietnam and doing the same thing. So in one sense, like, what the international legal system did is really just change the kind of paperwork that you have to do if you want to kill people in the third world. You have to couch it in this language of the law in terms of like proportionality and distinction, and you can call people like terrorists. And like, this was actually a common thing that happened to Vietnam, right? Like, I really do think like looking into the way the U.S. perpetrated the war in Vietnam also kind of illuminates the continuity with many of the tactics that the Israelis are currently using. And so that's just putting a note there that people should really read this book, Kill Anything That Moves by Nick Terse, which is really like harrowing and an awful account of U.S. bombing, more or less. I mean, they're also just like massacres on a more like with guns and stuff, but like bombing was really the way in which they carried out that campaign of genocidal violence. That and History of Bombing, those are my two big recommendations by Sven Lindqvist, kind of give you a picture into how aerial bombing especially has always been a tool of colonial management and colonial genocide, and continues to be to this day, and how those things are, how doing, you know, doing this violence from the air is of course like illegal, but the way the law was constructed is to kind of allow you to do these things as long as you say the right magic words. And that was very intentional. And it's like part of the history of aerial bombing. And it's like centrality to like our understanding of the law of war. But in any event, so like, but there was this world system that's like, even aside from everything I just said, there were these like kind of checks that you could have, which is that like places, like actions and like states drew their legitimacy from their adherence to the international legal order, right? And things were couched always in the language of like self-defense. And they had to be, because any violence that was not self-defense or like the defense of others was illegal. It's just like that's what the law created. That's what the UN Charter basically created. And so there were these kind of like, if we're thinking of law as this kind of like discursive field, the fact that everyone had to participate in it for legitimacy meant that everyone was like speaking the same language, and critiques could be imminent to the system itself, which made them much more powerful. And state action, like, it had like a weak regulating function, but there still was a regulating function. And what we saw, I think, in 2001 with the US unleashing the so-called global war on terror, which surely was global. It's not a war on terrorism, but like really a war on like the world's poor. What kind of emerged there is, this world system that had been collapsing under its own contradictions for quite some time. And those contradictions are, the US was at the head of it. And really the unspoken thing underlying the world system was US raw power. At the same time, the US also like cultivated and kind of helped spearhead like the, in some ways, or at least tolerated the gradual expansion of the international legal order to all of these other fields, and like the expansion of the treaty system, like human rights treaties and things like that. And weaker states had two conflicting imperatives. And one of them was to cozy up to US power, because that was kind of a true determining force, but also to see in international law and the international legal system a check on that force, and to try to expand its legitimacy and its power at the same time. And these two things are in conflict with one another. And because no one was able to like really challenge the United States in a way that checked it in a permanent fashion, its domination of the world system grew at the same time as the world system's greater claims to legitimacy and like legality also grew. And that contradiction like really reached ahead, I think, with the so-called war on terror, in which the US just unleashed this campaign of illegal and like unilateral violence on the entire world, which also saw like the global torture program and like torture as this like jus cogens norm. It's like you're really not supposed to commit war crimes, and torture is itself a war crime, but it's also its own crime. But like torture is one of those things that like you really are not supposed to do. You're like really not supposed to do that, and you're really not supposed to do acts of aggression. And the United States was doing both in a global sense, and it was still like couching this in terms of self-defense and defense of others, and was still kind of like trying to couch all of its manifesto legal actions, even the torture, in the language of the law. And like OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, like memos were drafted about this, and they still sought like kind of Security Council legitimacy and things like that. But it was very clear that they were operating under a kind of new logic, which was you're either with us or against us, as Bush very famously said. And that is not the logic of the law. That is the logic of an imperial power, and like a very like Schmittian like conception of sovereignty, right? And so like the global war on terror wasn't when these like cracks in the world system started to emerge, but it's when they like started to like really become visible, right? And that kind of like that bifurcation point that the crisis, or like basically like we it engendered a crisis, which is to say like the world system as we know it is collapsing. That started to become really visible in 2001 and onward. And now we're reaching like even a more decisive point in which the crisis, and what crisis means, is like it's going away and something else is going to come in its stead. We just don't know what it is yet. And so now you have historical actor or actors like intervening in a way to kind of shape what the new order is going to be. And what I think you see with, the Trump administration's actions in Venezuela, but also the way they're talking about it, as just like this is like very like return to Monroe Doctrine type language. Like, this is our backyard. We can do whatever we want. We're blowing these boats up because like they're an imminent threat, whatever language of the law, but that's ex post. Really, the way they justify it is we're doing this because we want to kill these guys. Like, we just want to kill them because we think they're bad. And it's our right to intervene across the world in order to protect the homeland, but also to shore up our economic interests and like a very, you know, like very crude imperialist way. That's what they're talking about, like Greenland, but they're talking about Venezuela even, right, in terms of its oil wealth. And like, that's something new. Like, that's something new, and that's something really bad. Or it's not something new, it's something old, but something old becoming new again. And that represents like the kind of like legal order which said aggression is bad, and like crude naked imperialism and crude naked colonialism, like you can't do those things. That going out the window, even with all of its problems and even with all of the horrific and like world destroying violence that took place during the 20th century, that losing that regulating function is not going to bring about a more peaceful world. It's going to bring about a much more violent one. And the world is going to be, I think, extraordinarily violent and bad until we get our way out of this crisis. And that might look like a world in which these like anti-systemic actors or like communist forces, socialist forces that we want to win, do win. Or it looks like a world of global fascism, where the fascist threat is not actually contained and destroyed so that like liberal economic expansion can start going on like it was in World War II, but rather actually becomes the order of the day. And that is what I think we can see very much in Venezuela, but it's also what I think we can see very much in Gaza, which is the Israelis perpetrating a colonial genocide, one in which they are exterminating a group of like subjugated people under occupation in order to exterminate them from the land and seize the land and expand. And like that is like so explicitly not the thing that's not allowed, which is that like settler colonialism. And of course it persists. And one reason that like the Palestinians like seem like against the current of the time is because these questions of colonialism and like racism that have always persisted underneath like the advance of the liberal international order were thought to have been decisively resolved, but they're actually kind of the bad conscience of the international order, which is like that colonial subject that was always at its core. And the Israelis and the Americans are not so much doing things that weren't done before, but doing them openly and brazenly and celebrating the kind of raw power, which like Alberto Toscano talks about, like this difference between liberalism in the United States, or like, yeah, liberalism and fascism is like one of the things that changes is those negative and like bad side effects, the like the dirty work of the liberal order that it used to maintain itself actually comes out of the shadows and becomes a principle, elevated to a principle as such, and everyone celebrates it. And, you know, there was this dream inherent in the old world, the old international order that is now dead and dying, which was like a world without war, without aggression, and like premised on like respect of sovereignty and like comity between states. And now like what the Americans and the Israelis are really advancing with their imperial or colonial projects, right, is that like domination and violence are not only like normative and normal, but like, or I guess I say not only normal like parts of the system, but actually normative, that like this is actually what it means to be an actor on the world stage, is enforcing your will against others and the law and others as such, be damned. And they're like, yeah, they're like realizing, as I said kind of earlier, realizing a universalizing project, which is just casting the world into this like universal hell. That like the like telos of world history is the ever greater particularity of nation states, which all participate in this like violence of all against all, and let the stronger prevail. And yeah, I mean, that's what we're seeing now, but this is really like, it is both the whole horror and also only the beginning of it.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's a strange place to end, but I do also think that, I guess that part of why I wanted to finish with that question also relates back to the importance for a kind of historical continuity and a kind of novel formations of longstanding historical tendencies. And to me, that's kind of, you know, I feel like a lot of what I'm learning from reading your writing is just that. So Jake, thank you so much. Are there any kind of final points you want to end on? I mean, I know that's a bit of a kind of bombshell to finish in terms of the old world is dying and the new one is yet to be born.
I guess it really is the time of monsters, but the thing is, right, like it is, like I think part of, I guess the thing I want to end on is not exactly a hopeful note, but it is dying, right? The old world is dying. And that means that the new one is like, right? Like we can shape it. And like part of the importance of Palestinian liberation is not just that it's like a moral imperative in its own right. Like these are subjugated people who, like every people on earth, deserves to be free. Mm-hmm. But it is also like one of the first large battles in shaping this new world order. And of course, like the PFLP very much understood this, like each blow against the imperialist in one area is a blow against imperialism in toto. And I think that's still very much alive, and like really like the unconditional solidarity with the Palestinians and with Palestinian resistance is not just, again, a moral imperative in its own right, but there's also like, you need to be thinking prudentially and for yourself as well, that every battle against this emerging like fascist international order is one in which you need to support the people fighting against that fascism. And yeah, it really is like the moral imperative of our time.
Thank you for listening to Red Medicine, and thank you to Jake for such a great conversation. Once again, if you haven't already, make sure you go and have a look at those essays. And if you'd like to support Red Medicine, please consider signing up for a monthly donation, giving the show 5 stars, or sharing this episode with someone you think might like it. Thanks again.